Hello and welcome to Navara FM, brought to you by Navara Media and broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's most exciting and groundbreaking of radio stations. I am James Butler. It is, of course, an election period, and over this election, we will be bringing you a look at what all the parties are doing through the lens of experts and big policy issues, what things look like they're changing, and what's not changed at all. And of course, one thing that we know is changing is the climate. Climate change has never really been an electoral issue in this country, but it looks like that might be changing. At its conference this year, the Labour Party adopted policy on a Green New Deal, and Boris Johnson earlier this week launched his campaign by talking about green production and technology at an electric car factory. All the political parties have adopted a range of different targets for decarbonisation, ranging from 2030 to 2050. But what does that all mean in practical terms? How might it happen? And what does it mean for the rest of politics? Last night, I caught up with Anne Pettifor, who is author, among other things, of The Case for a Green New Deal, which is out now from Verso, and is renowned as one of the most effective communicators on progressive economics. And we talked about the new relationship between climate politics and economics, as well as just what the latest economic statistics tell us about the objective state of the country.
Sure.
So I guess the place to start is to say, you know, ecological politics has become a battleground like it hasn't been before, I think, yes. In this election. I mean, Boris Johnson yesterday actually dropped the word sort of green industrial revolution into his speech when he was launching launching his campaign. And obviously the Green New Deal was taken up by Labour at its conference this year. I guess where to start is, like, is this just an inevitable consequence of the political moment? Because I think parties these days have at least to be seen to acknowledge climate policy and acknowledge really the scale of it as well. While at the same time, I guess the government has missed climate targets this week. It's right back on these things.
So is
the prominence, do you think, just a consequence of this political moment?
Do you know that I was stunned today? I don't know if you've seen today's Mirror.
Yes.
The Daily Mirror has gone green.
Yeah.
And it's an extraordinary addition, actually, because, you know, front page, little babe saying, give me a future. But there's food, there's planting trees, there's celebrities, Paul McCartney, you know, all of that. I just think it's extraordinary. So, yes, it is partly the moment. It's also the flooding of the River Don and what is happening up there. And then it's the Extreme Rebellion crowd and young Greta and the school strikers. You know, I have two grandchildren and they've already been school striking. And it's been quite tricky because teachers are not happy with that. So for the kids to do this, it takes quite a lot of courage, actually. And I mean, the fact that children have had to pull us by the nose, so to speak, into the real world has been amazing. So, no, I don't think it's just... it's just the moment. I think it is a profound change, but I just don't think it's fast enough. Mm. I don't think it's, and it's certainly not at the level of what of structural change, which is what I hope we can talk about with the Green New Deal. The level is still at what, you know, should we do what Paul McCartney says and stop eating meat? Should we stop flying and that kind of stuff? This is behavioural change. And it's worthy and very important and a big part of the change. And then there's community change. We must be recycling and reusing and all of that and being more participatory and so on. But that's also not structural change. We haven't yet got to talk about why we emissions have been rising as fast as they have and what the driver is. And for me, that's the really big question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's... I was just thinking today that obviously there are these two terms that are now in circulation. The Labour Party seems to use them interchangeably, Green New Deal and Green Industrial Revolution.
Yes, yes.
I think it's perhaps unsurprising that the Conservative Party wants to avoid the suggestion of a New Deal of any
kind. Of course,
kind.
Of course.
But do you see there as being a difference between those two terms?
I do, indeed. And I think it's problematic. First of all, you know, the reason I'm attached to the term New Deal is precisely because the New Deal tackled the big, bad financial system. You know, the very first thing Roosevelt did on the night of his inauguration was to begin to dismantle the gold standard, which was another word for the globalization of that time. And that was the very first thing he did. He knew he had to do that if government was going to be put in the driving seat of the economy and not Wall Street. And that's why the New Deal is so powerful for us. And that is why the Tories won't use it. But it's also, I think, why there are elements in the Labour Party that are reluctant to use it. And perhaps they don't know the history, and so maybe I shouldn't be attributing that to them. But I think everyone knows there was a radical transformation took place in the United States. In Europe at that time, the Germans and others stuck with the gold standard, and we know what happened then, really. Mm-hmm. In democratic terms, that is. But so the Green Industrial Revolution is, I think, bowing to the interests of, and the right interests of, the trade unions that are organised at Heathrow Airport and building HS2 and so on. And we have a really terrible legacy to tackle, which is that Margaret Thatcher looms over this current crisis in the sense that steel workers in other big industries believe that we are treating them in the way she treated the miners, that we will be as careless of them as she was of the miners. And to overcome that view is really, really hard because, you know, it's a deep pain, it's deep scar on the nation's psyche. Mm. And now we're asking workers once again to accept that there's going to have to be a transformation and a transition. And I think our policymakers are slow to promise that that's going to be well financed, that they're going to be have their skills upgraded as a result, and they're going to be better paid, and that actually it is going to be a better place for them to be than where they are at the moment, subject to the whims of global capital. You know?
I mean, I guess there's it's interesting in some ways that the way in which sort of people hope that this will play into the election. I mean, there have been climate elections elsewhere recently and this year. So the Australian election, you know, the left in Australia wanted to fight it as a climate election. It was not a very successful one for them.
No, not at all.
And so I wonder, you know, if you think there's... Because a lot of people on the left think that, you know, climate should be a natural issue for the left to sort of profit from.
Yes.
But one of the things that I guess seems to be true, and I don't know much about the Australian election, I sort of followed it here and there, but I wasn't... Certainly not as immersed as I am in this one.
Yes.
But one of the things that seems to be true from it is that, you know, it doesn't work very well unless you're putting it in some kind of tangible terms, right? So the kind of a climate election doesn't work unless it has something kind of tangible that can be communicated. And you've been very successful at communicating some of the realities of progressive economics. How do you put flesh on the bones of something like a progressive climate policy?
It's really hard. It is a very hard thing to do. But I think we have to promise people that actually we have the talent, the empathy, the intelligence to do something profound with this transformation that's profoundly good for us, basically. You know, we live in a world of deep alienation, in my view, at the moment. We're governed by remote market forces. And the notion, I'm very keen on us thinking more about localization and also about self-sufficiency, right? And there's a very fine border between those aspirations and nationalism and all of that. And then there's the whole question of internationalism and so on. But I think that people understand that our interests here at home are being discarded, are being neglected in favor of interests which appear to be remote and unaccountable. And I think we really have to start talking to people about how we want to regain, I don't like to use control because it's not a nice word, regain management or oversight of our own economy to benefit our own people. And I think people are worried about talking about that in nationalistic terms, and so am I. I grew up under a nationalist government and I hate nationalism of any kind. But we do have to say, look, within the boundaries of our nation, we want to look after the interests of our people. And the political parties should be having that as their priority, instead of looking after the interests of foreign capital. Mm. So that's one way of looking at it. But I think also we have to admit that we already have localization taking place. I know that where I live in Suffolk, people want to buy locally. They want to buy from the local farmers. Farmers' markets are doing really well. They want to know the provenance of what they're eating and all that. and they're being very fussy about all that. And also they want the sense of community. We all yearn to belong. We all yearn to belong. And I think we have to talk about it in those terms, and about that's what the transformation will do. And also about autonomy, that we would actually be governing ourselves. Mm. You know, Alan Greenspan famously said that it didn't matter who the hell was elected as president of the United States, because the world was governed by markets. And the problem is markets are very remote, they're unaccountable, we never see them. We want to govern ourselves, and that sense of restoring autonomy, I think, is really important. And to do that, to save nature. And again, I mean, the RSPB is the biggest membership organization in the country. Why? People care about little birds, you know. They care passionately about little birds. And they care about nature much more than anyone gives them credit for. So bringing all of that together, and how you do that, we need bigger brains than mine, I'm afraid, to kind of knit all that together and make it attractive to the electorate. But I'm convinced we can. I think we're halfway there.
I mean, so in a bit to your work on the Green New Deal, because obviously this started in 2008, right?
Indeed.
And I actually remember, I was at university at the time, I remember sort of things coming out from you, but also
Caroline Lucas, yes, of course, because yeah. her name was, and so
this is in the wake of the financial crisis, yeah. Right? And there was this sort of transatlantic movement that it seemed to have ended up in the United States and sort of come back.
Yes.
Here. So it's done that kind of round trip. I mean,
don't tell the Americans that, because they don't like to think that, you know, they didn't invent it.
Well, Americans always like to believe that they're original. Hmm. Very rarely are. But But no, I mean, you know, I think the thing that's interesting in some ways is that, you know, obviously you talk about, you've mentioned briefly Roosevelt, and I think we should sort of talk about Roosevelt in more depth in a bit. But in 2008 there was a crisis, really very clear crisis.
Yeah.
And you know, this was articulated just as Roosevelt's New Deal was articulated in response to that crisis.
Yeah.
There isn't currently a financial crisis.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Maybe we can come onto that as well in a bit. But there has been sort of some serious conversation about how to pay for it. And this is one of the things that you're kind of very, very clear on. Now, obviously, this has been particularly controversial in the United States, where Bernie Sanders has said things like, I think it was $16.3 trillion that he wants to invest in, you know.
Over 10 years.
Yeah, over 10 years.
Which is peanuts, really, for the Americans.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I imagine the military budget rather dwarfs
it. Exactly.
But so that's on infrastructure investment and so on. But he talks about it in terms of taxation.
Yeah.
And I get the sense that for you, that's probably not the right way to talk about these things.
So frustrated by that. And, you know, and the thing is, here are we. I mean, I'm so glad that Novara Media exists, but we're up against, you know, the Today Programme and the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the Office for Budget Responsibility and the UK Treasury, all of whom argue that until we go around with a tin collecting taxes, we can't spend a penny, you know. But me, I can go into a department store and order a washing machine with nothing more than a little credit card. Mm-hmm. There's no money in my credit card. Nobody has put any money in my credit card before I promised to pay for that washing machine. And that's how I get a washing machine. That's how the department store gets paid. And I pay it from future income. And that's how government is financed. Mm-hmm. It isn't financed from future. It's not financed from taxation. So I'm really angry about that, because the IFS is their analysis is microeconomic. Mm. Now, in the sphere, just to gossip a little bit, but in the world of economists, I heard the head of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research say very disparagingly about the IFS the other day that they did not have a macroeconomic framework. And, you know, for anyone to say that about a national institution is extraordinary. It's extraordinarily embarrassing, actually, but I don't know if the IFS was embarrassed. Now, the point about 2008, I agree this was a moment, but I want to take you back there, because in 2008, we were midway through the crisis, but honestly, the public did not know that we were in that crisis. And more importantly, the left did not know we were in the crisis. And it always stuns me, and it stunned me then, that it wasn't until Lehman's collapsed in October 2008 that people became aware of a crisis that began with the credit crunch on the 9th of August 2007. So this thing had been rolling for more than a year, that when not just the public, but central bankers and economists and all the big shots kind of work up to the scale of this crisis. And we wrote the Green New Deal report over that year. We thought it was an extraordinary opportunity for the left, both to tackle the climate issue, but also to tackle the financial crisis. And unfortunately, we were eclipsed by the collapse of Lehman's. But what was extraordinary for me was that because the left had no plan, had no alternative, you know, in that moment, in that hiatus, the bankers believed they were going to go to jail. Mm. And they were really scared. There was that period when they sat on the edge of their seats thinking, oh dear, this is it. And then to their absolute astonishment, rather than going to jail, they were rewarded with government guarantees, right? They could now go and do crazy stuff, knowing they would never have to face the discipline of the market or the burden of losses, because taxpayers were now backing them. They are now too big to fail and too big to jail. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and where was the left in all that? And it was that vacuum that made me so angry, because the left stood around saying, oh dear, what's happened? We didn't know this could happen. How did it happen? Who, what? You know, we did not have an analysis. Mm. And that's why I think it's so important to develop the Green New Deal, because, you know, discussing with the public, it's hard. All of this communication is tough. Wait till the next crisis, right? And it's not far away. In my view, it could be a climate breakdown. You know, London could be flooded. I was doing an interview on the banks of the Thames the other day outside Parliament, and you know, the concrete walls holding in the river are really high, and the problem with that is that you force the volumes to rise because the water has nowhere to go, right? And so we know that to deal with that kind of flooding, you actually should not have concrete walls. Imagine the day when Westminster disappears underwater, or when there's another Hurricane Sandy and Wall Street disappears underwater. Nobody cares when Bangladesh goes under, but the day New York goes under will be, you know, or when Silicon Valley burns down, essentially, which is also not entirely improbable. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was amazed when they shut down all the energy for a whole weekend. I wondered how on earth Silicon Valley managed. And of course, they'd have all had to go and buy generators, really. But you've got to have a big generator to survive the close down of your... Anyway, so take that sort of crisis. And then the third possibility, which is probably more remote, is the possibility of war, really. You know, when you have trade wars, you get real wars. Mm-hmm. That may be easing at the moment, but, you know, the world is particularly unbalanced at the moment. When that happens, where will the left be? Mm-hmm. Will we have a plan? Will we know what has to be done? Will we use the opportunity? And my fear is that we won't, because we won't know it's had to happen. We'd still be thinking, oh, gosh, we've got to go around with a tin and collect some taxes to pay for the transformation. So I really want to see that analysis of how the financial system works changed, so that when we get our hands, if we, you know, get into the driving seat of the economy, and let's hope that happens on the 12th of December, then that we know what it is that has to be done.
I mean, I think this place, I don't think that is a serious call to take seriously. I mean, it is a problem, isn't it, that there is a bias towards assuming there is a steady state in politics or indeed in political economy, which is questionable.
Yeah, indeed. You know.
But I mean, the stuff you're highlighting there plays into one of, I think, that is a concern throughout your work, actually, in terms of questions about control over the financial system. One of the themes of the recent book is you know, treating the financial system as a public system, right? And I think that's very clear in the book. And obviously that's true, like in a very obvious way, which is that money is the nexus of exchange between people. We all use it. We all need it. It's also very much these days a global system, right? Which is what you're talking about. So a lot of power is accrued by these kind of money organizations, banks, central banks, credit companies, fund managers, large corporations as well. So I guess the question in one sense is, so there has been an attitude, I think, among politicians of every hue, right? Mm. I mean, from New Labour to the coalition to the kind of pure Tory government, that actually, you know, there aren't national, well, you know, one, it might not be desirable to rein them in any way, anyway, but even if you wanted to, that there aren't the policy tools that we have in a national context to deal with them. And so it seems to me that that question is vital. What policy tools are there?
Well, this is the thing. My mission at the moment is to persuade the public to understand its power, right? That BlackRock and Goldman Sachs, all those big financial institutions, depend on several sources of wealth which are funded and backed by taxpayers. So, for example, if a company wants to deal in sterling and it needs currency, it would go to the Bank of England for currency. Now, currency and the sterling is a valuable asset. Why is it valuable? It's valuable because it's backed by 30 million taxpayers, right? If there weren't 30 million of us playing up, in a job, or in work enough to be able to be paying taxes, and if we didn't faithfully pay our taxes every month or whenever it is we pay our taxes, our currency would fall in value. The United States has 140 million taxpayers, so her currency is even more powerful. And the European Union has 160 or more, I can't remember how many millions of taxpayers there are in the European Union, but that makes the euro powerful. Right. Go to Malawi, and Malawi has hardly any taxpayers. It doesn't have a tax collection system. It doesn't have the public tax-funded institutions needed for an independent currency and so on. And so Malawi has no money, right? So we need to understand that this thing, the currency, depends on us, the taxpayers. Secondly, government debt is a major and valuable asset to all these financiers. They need debt because it's collateral. And why is it collateral? Well, because it is a very valuable piece of collateral. It's a bond where the British government promises to pay over the next 30 years a rate of interest and return the full payment over due course, and is backed by 30 million taxpayers, right? Now, the question is, who gets to play with our assets? Mm-hmm. Number one, we've been discouraged from creating these assets, from spending, from government spending, and therefore borrowing more and creating these valuable assets called government bonds or treasury bills. We've been discouraged from that. So these poor guys, you know, running big, powerful asset management funds worth $6.5 trillion, can't get their hands on enough British assets. British debt, thanks to austerity, mm-hmm. right? So again, we need to understand that debt is a valuable asset, unlike sort of London property, which can degrade and can fall in value. And, there's lots of things can go wrong with a building, but not with a government bond. Or if you buy a work of art by Picasso, that could, and you put it in a vault in Dubai somewhere, the vault could flood or something and you could lose your... No. With a government asset, you have a really safe thing. And it's our money. It's our taxpayers' money. It's our spending. And they can't wait to get their hands on it. So I want to help people understand that as taxpayers, for me, how do we manage these guys? Well, we just simply say, if you want access to QE, the Bank of England, which is a nationalised bank, nationalised by the Labour government in 1945 because they behaved so stupidly during the 30s, then these are the terms and conditions, mate. Mm-hmm. These are the terms and conditions, BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, HSBC, whichever these are, who want access to QE, that want to use our currency, there are terms and conditions, and we want to set them. Right now, they have access to all these resources without terms and conditions. They have access to our debt, our assets, without terms and conditions. And they come here and invest in our economy and don't pay taxes either, mm-hmm. because we've allowed them to just move their money out. And then we complain because they don't pay taxes, and we set up very virtuous organizations like the Tax Justice Network, and we say tut 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 tut. But in the meantime, we've given them permission to move their money away, right? So we've just got to withdraw that permission. Mm-hmm. And clearly, it would be better if we could do it in coordination with other countries. And it would be much better if we did it with the Europeans, because there's a lot of them. And between us, we would be a force to challenge global finance on our little island by ourselves. That ain't going to be so easy. So for me, it isn't difficult. And you know, we don't have to be draconian about it. We don't have to be dictatorial. We don't have to be fascist about it. We can simply say, of course you can have access to QE. We'd very want to help you out. These are the terms and conditions. It's as simple as that. But the public don't understand that we have that leverage.
Right,
the public thinks that finance is something over there. There's a Bank of England or some high-powered institution beyond their knowledge. You know, I mean, it's nonsense.
I mean, I think even on so simpler levels, someone hears the word debt and goes,
exactly.
That's terrifying. A debt is a bad thing. Do not have debt, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And this is obviously, I mean, that analogy between the household and,
of course,
the nation state
is,
of course, as we've all said many times, completely wrong, but it's a very powerful one.
Yeah, yeah. And let's face it, too much debt is a problem, really. But on the other hand, you know, living in a country like Malawi that doesn't have a monetary system underpinned by good public institutions means they don't have money. We have publicly financed and publicly regulated institutions, which means there can never be a shortage of money in a country like ours with a developed monetary system. Might be a shortage of foreign money. That's always a problem, you know, getting other people's money. Mm. But our own money in sterling ain't never going to be a shortage, really. And that's why we can afford to finance the Green New Deal.
Let's talk a little bit more about Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, your conception of the Green New Deal, and particularly what it would mean for people here, both in terms of, you know, what everyone does in society, but also, you know, just actually the scale of the action needed. And in some ways, you know, there's a shadow hanging over this, right? Because, like, actually the crisis that's sort of shaking its way through the British political system at the moment is not one that is necessarily amenable to this kind of thing. I think Brexit probably, takes away the ability for people to think in these terms in some ways.
Yeah.
But so you take, you know, this inspiration from FDR, and you talk about Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps, who are pretty astonishing, actually.
Yes, yeah.
So they plant
3 billion trees in no time at all.
To deal
with the Dust Bowl.
Yeah. Yeah, and then sort of state parks, so there's kind of aspect of kind of public access to it.
Yeah.
And as well as sort of, you know, obviously, and in some ways the most obvious thing is sort of job creation. So I think this puts in view something that hasn't been part of the debate before, and particularly because debate over climate gets very, very heavily policy driven very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And here there's an aspect to it which is about kind of popular mobilization. Mm. So how do you see that move to a sustainable economy transforming the way in which people live their lives?
So, well, first of all, on Roosevelt, I just need to say this. You know, I'm in awe of the fact that he had the courage to take on Wall Street on the day of his inauguration, and he pulled him down. He just said, hand over the gold. I want the gold. You're no longer in the driving seat of the economy. And I think that was awesome, as the Americans say, awesome. But the guy was deeply flawed as well. And one of the deep flaws was he set up, I mean, once the administration was in the driving seat, they then were freed up to spend, whereas they'd had lived through an era of austerity under Hoover. And so he begins creating jobs, and he sets up these conservation corps groups. Now, first of all, they're extremely racist. They were segregated into black, Indian, and white, and there were far more white conservation corps. And then he excludes women from them. And despite the fact that he's married to a feminist, Eleanor Roosevelt, who wanted women to be in, to have their own conservation corps, and he said, no, women should stay at home and mind the babies. You know, so there's an awful lot wrong with Roosevelt as well. And I just want nobody to think that I think he's unblemished. But it is that thing he did on the gold standard, which was transformative. So I'm losing track a little bit of our question,
it's
really.
About the way in which people live their lives.
Yes.
Right? Because so this is a state-led major change, but one which involves people like actively mobilizing. So in some of the ways that we talk about policy on climate, it's like, oh, we'll put a levy here and we'll invest here, or we'll sort of stop investing here.
Yeah.
This is actually a policy which involves many people, you know, effectively an entire new sector of the economy.
Yeah.
So that, you know, and one of the things that you talk about is actually how, you know, these drives by FDR, you know, fundamentally changed the way in which, like, people were living.
Yes, indeed.
So what does that look like now?
So, well, the thing is, I mean, of course, they had a very similar context because they'd had 29, then they had 4 years of austerity, and he campaigns. So, and the campaign, I imagine, was pretty dirty. You know, I'm not sure that the mafia weren't involved at mm-hmm. some stage and so on in his bid for the primaries. But he went around telling people that he was going to make their lives better, that he was going to give them jobs, going to make sure they had jobs and that they would have a decent income. And, I mean, I think that was the thing about him. And he was also extremely eloquent and had a lovely sense of humour. But it was his promise that, don't worry, you know, we've all been through hell, but we have an answer. And, you know, I'm very struck that the movements, the labour movement and the left at the time was extraordinarily weak. If you read the history, you know, there was a little strike, and it was the strike of the veterans who weren't getting their pensions, and they camped outside the White House. But really, there wasn't. The farmers were burning down their own farms and their houses, but they were doing that in isolation, far away from the world, you know, and committing suicide, essentially. There wasn't this collective organisation behind him. What there was number one, leadership, and I'm a great one for leadership. You know, I worked in the NGO sector all my life, and I know NGOs don't like leadership. You know, we've all got to have bottom-up participation, and I'm deeply in favour of bottom-up participation. But I think you have to have both, basically. And we, especially women, underrate the importance of leadership. And leadership doesn't mean dictation. You know, Mandela wasn't a dictator. He was an inspirer. He mobilized, he empowered people. And I think to an extent that's what Roosevelt did. And I think it takes that. It takes a vision, and it takes determination and political commitment, but it of giving people hope. And there is a great deal to be hopeful for and hopeful about. But also because, you know, for me, the Brexit moment is about how the public does instinctively understand what's going wrong. The British elites have colluded with global finance to mess us all up. And then they've said to us, sorry, nothing to do with me, Gov. Parliament can't do anything about this. The market decides whether you go to university. The market decides whether you can afford a house in London. The market decides whether or not, you know, you can have healthcare. And if you don't like that, tough, nothing to do with me. I'd love to help you, but I'm only a politician. And the public are aware of this. And they're saying, right, if you can't help me, I'm going to find some other way to seek protection from these forces. And I think is a real vacuum of leadership at the top of our. And you know, I'm thrilled with the Corbyn phenomenon. I'm thrilled with the new people at the top of the Labour Party. But they're having to clear up an awful long mess. And I think people haven't forgiven Labour for the Iraq war, for the collusion over austerity, for the financial crisis, the collusion with the City of London and so on. And I know those are harsh words, but I think it's how the public feels, you know. And so now how do we turn that around? Well, we turn that around by disowning that and saying, look, you know, and I think Corbyn does that. The great appeal of Jeremy Corbyn, that he's a decent man. He's clearly hasn't been bought by anybody and doesn't want to be bought. He has no ambition to be a big shot in the City of London. And he's genuine. He's actually very sincere. And the public are yearning for that kind of leadership. The question is, is there enough time for that to work with the public?
I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's an aspect to Jeremy Corbyn, which is sort of, in some ways, rather austere. I don't mean that in a sort of austerity-embracing way, but one which is sort of not...
Yeah.
Consumerist,
yes,
I think. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is the way in which actually, you know, it's funny, isn't it, that historically on the left there was a discourse around consumerism, which seems to have, you know, rather disappeared from view over the course of the past decade or so, maybe a bit longer.
Yeah.
But it was certainly there, I think, even at the turn of the millennium. But if you go back to the sort of 1960s and you have people really thinking about the dangers of this stuff. And it's one of the things that I think came through to me while reading your recent book is that actually, you know, there are fundamental things about the way in which we live our lives that are going to have to change. Yeah. And I mean, the obvious one is stuff like, you know, motorized transportation.
Yeah.
But that, you know, in a sense, and this is, you know, one of the claims that someone like Andreas Malm makes in his book on fossil capital, right? He says, you know, industrial revolution and fossil fuels are entwined. They grow up together, and the speed at which people live their lives, you know, is predicated on there being these kind of you know, hugely energetic fuels that we can, you know, one, just sort of pump stuff out all the time, but also like get somewhere very fast.
Yeah.
So it does seem to me that one of the things, and it's not something we talk about often because I think it's sometimes, you know, we fear alienating people and say like, well, you won't be able to live actually
with that level of extravagance. Yeah, you won't be able to buy a new outfit every week and then post it back to the shop and that kind of thing.
You hate sort of fashion.
I did mention Vogue in my book, and my best friend in New York said, "Oh my God, Anne, it's the end of the world if you're saying." And you know, I'm in favor of fashion, and and as a 72-year-old, I like to feel that I'm ahead of the game in those terms. But I also like simplicity, and I think it's all got too much and too complicated and too competitive. So yes, I think we're going to have to live very differently. But I also think the public yearns for that, really. I mean, when you wander down Oxford Street, you see an awful lot of really lonely people trying to satisfy their loneliness by shopping, basically. And I've done the same myself. So we've all been there. So I know that, you know, when people are working in community, when they're in nature, when they're in meaningful relationships with their loved ones, they're really, really happy. And I think we have to start talking about that. That's really matters, you know. And that's the sort of, so we're going to have a different lifestyle. We're not going to be able to have that rate of turnover in clothing, for example, but we're going to go back to simple materials. You know, I hope we go back to wool. I mean, it breaks my heart when I see all the sheep's wool that just effectively gets abandoned. When, you know, I grew up on my mother knitting all of our jumpers and so on and so forth, my grandmother. And, you know, I don't see any harm in that, really. I think we can do it beautifully. We can make them beautiful. We can make them fashionable. But above all, we can make them sustainable. And there will be something in our inner selves that will be satisfied by that, I think.
I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about what you're saying there in terms of kind of the faces of people on Oxford Street. And it's funny, isn't it, that that there's such this boom in the sort of wellness industry and these sort of apps that are like, you feel alienated and miserable all the time, but, you know, buy this app and then you'll feel good. But maybe buy this.
Light a candle going to be better. Yes.
But so I do think that there is obviously that kind of desire there in some ways. I guess the concern in some ways, or maybe actually the more interesting way to phrase this is why. Because there is a construction you can put on this.
Yeah.
So, for instance, you quote Keynes about kind of homespun
goods. Let goods be homespun. Yeah.
But finance be radical.
No, let finance be national.
National.
Yes. And let ideas be international and art and all of those things. And for goodness sake, let's all of us work internationally and coordinate internationally. But finance should be national and goods should be homespun. I mean, basically he's saying free trade is a problem. It's not a good thing. There's no such thing as free trade, of course.
I mean, but this is the thing, isn't it? Is that you can put a kind of conservative spin on this stuff. And I guess the interesting question is why, in effect, and I guess it has started to a bit on a very kind of superficial level, but why a sort of green conservatism hasn't really emerged. Michael Gove tried to do it a bit, and then Boris Johnson is sort of trying it a bit, apparently under the influence of his new partner. I guess you can make a case, like someone like Rory Stewart maybe.
Well, exactly.
Does it a bit, stewardship of nature, and
but
then, you know, hyper-localization, growing your own food and that kind of stuff, you know, you can spin that in a conservative direction. Is that a danger?
I suspect it can be. I mean, I think the spectre of nationalism and of eco-fascism, you know, is out there. But I am surprised. I mean, I think the attachment to the City of London is so great that they can't do this. And that would be to their detriment, I would hope, but it doesn't seem at the moment that it will be. But no, it is surprising because, as you say, they are, well, they, you know, to conserve is a very different concept from today's conservatism. And as we know, today's Conservative Party is splintered apart, really. But they don't have to be conservative, I hope, you know. But I think the reason I think we have to think in those terms is because we cannot have an economy where we rely on draining Kenya's water table in order to, for Kenyan, low-paid Kenyans to grow green beans for us and then fly them over so we can have them 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. And we want to eat avocados every single day. But I mean, I see in my everyday life that people are now preferring seasonal goods. I mean, when I see asparagus on the shelves in November, you know, I wince because I know the best asparagus comes out in May, June, you know. And I'm not alone. There's a lot of people out there. So this movement is happening already. And the question is how to build on it in a positive way, not in a not a protective, nationalist, protectionist way. Really.
It's funny because it puts me in mind of that line of Thatcher's, you know, economics is the method, but the objective is to change the soul or whatever.
Exact
phrasing. Yes. But it does strike me that there has to be some kind of economic support for that sort of change. And I guess, you know, I was reading the American Marxist writer Mike Davis the other day. This beautiful essay. It's one of my favorite essays, Who Will Build the Ark? And the first bit is about, you know, how terrible climate change is and how it might destroy us all. And the second part is attempting to kind of envision, you know, what kind of change might happen. He talks, you know, he develops this concept of public affluence.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like
public
that
wealth.
Right,
yes.
That it accords very, very well with the sort of, you know, the bits of Keynes that don't get talked about a lot, but which are very much about this kind of shared and collective.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm also very aware of Keynes's sort of class war, I'm on the position of the educated bourgeoisie, etc.
No, exactly. Yeah.
But it does seem to me that there is, you know, scope for thinking about, you know, shared and public goods in that way.
I love the way George Mumbai talks about public wealth, you know, and about how the more we privatize the land, the smaller the tiny plots of land are that we get. And little kiddywinkies can't, you know, swing a cat in the back garden. But a big public space where they can run wild with their friends and so on is a form of wealth that, you know, is now denied. And I mean, I've walked around, canvassed, as we all do, housing estates with teeny weeny little gardens, and you see kids, and they can't play in the street because of the cars, and they're stuck in these tiny, bashing football against a wall, you know. And so this idea of public space shared, which is public wealth, is something, I mean, we've been so indoctrinated by the individualism and the narrow-mindedness of what has really been predominant conservative thinking. I think we've got to get out of that.
You know? I just want to ask a final question on sort of ecology, really, which is that, you know, ecology and economics have often been sort of distrustful of each other or have had their faces pointed in other directions, right?
Yes, yeah.
And of course, I'm generalizing a bit,
but
I think it has historically been the case. And there's been a recent catchphrase sort of flying around on Twitter and places like that. You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet.
Yes.
I rather like.
Yes.
But does this present problems to the way economics has been done?
Yes, it does. And, you know, I have a thing about this because growth is a very neoliberal concept and it's also a relatively modern one. Interestingly, Keynes never talked about growth rates. He always talked about levels of activity. Is unemployment too high? Is it too low? Is investment too high or is it too low? If it's too high, then we'd get inflation. Is output too high or too low? If, you know, and so on and so forth. And then in the 1960s, the neoliberals come along at the OECD and working with Samuel Britton, who at the time was an economics editor on the Financial Times, they decide they're going to give Britain a target for growing at the same rate as the financial sector is growing. And the financial sector, now increasingly deregulated, is growing at an exponential rate. And so they give Britain a target of growth of 50% within 10 years at a time of full employment. Now, you need to know that when an economy is at full employment, it's at full capacity. It can't grow much more than that. And if you do try and extend it beyond full employment, you get inflation. So what happened? We got inflation in the 1970s. Who got the blame? The trade unions got the blame and Keynes got the blame, right? But it was a very deliberate neoliberal strategy to sort of force the real economy to make the same rate of returns as the financial economy was making from gambling, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about it, I don't want us to even use the word, because even the word degrowth, you know, negate a frame is to reinforce the frame. Just by negating, we reinforce it. So we need to just cut out that language. And we have to say to ourselves that ours has got to have to be a steady state economy. We're going to have to think of the economy as a lake, and with inputs and outputs, you know, and the outputs are death and depreciation, and the inputs are births and artifacts. And if you shove too many artifacts into the lake, it'll spill over. And if you have too many births, it's going to spill over. And if you don't have enough people dying in time, your lake is going to be, you know. So we've got to keep the economy that is the lake fairly stable. That means we've got to manage inputs. And that is absolutely essential to survival. But it is going to require restraint. Mm. It's going to require restraints and constraints. And we definitely can't talk about exponential expansion. Remember, the growth means expansion for economists. They expect the economy always to expand a bit more, to invest more and grow more. You know, and it's quite hard not to use the words. But they never expected to wilt and fall over and die. Mm-hmm. And of course, it does that too. But that word never, the wilting economy never turns up.
I mean, that's it. That's a nice one to sort of segue just into the ONS figures that we've had this week.
Yeah.
So I think growth is at 0.3%, says the ONS.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, like, what do these things tell us about the state of the economy?
Well, two things. One, that in 2010, George Osborne massively restructured the economy and, if you like, turned it down several gears, shrunk it to quite a lower level, and we've chunted along for the last 10 years with nothing much happening. Employment has expanded, but that's been, as we know, low-paid, insecure kind of employment, which they love. Mm. They're very happy about, the Tories, that is. There's only one bit of good news in the announcements this week, is that for the last 10 years since 2010, wages have been at the level they were at in 2005, right? And you know what? It's got better, because now wages are at the level they were in, wait for it, 2007. So 12 years later, we're back where we were in 2007. And what that tells you about the economy is why we're having Brexit, why we're having this really polarizing election campaign, is people are mad as hell because they know they've been cheated. Because the 1% have grown. I mean, nobody bothers to calculate how much they've grown, because it's so exponentially high, really. And we can all see that. It's blindingly obvious. So what the ONS figures do this week is to say, you know, we're still operating at the suboptimal level. We're way behind our comparable partners in the OECD. We're way down the the league table, and we look rather pathetic, actually.
It also struck me, there was something from the IPPR yesterday, which was just pointing out that growth is also regionally incredibly unbalanced in the UK, which is something that I don't think is necessarily talked about enough.
No, of course not.
But it does seem to me that if you want to seek, and as you're suggesting, if you want to seek sort of the economic roots of the crisis.
Yeah. And it is an ongoing crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it does seem to me that it's odd. And I was saying this earlier this week, it's odd to me. I find it odd when I listen to politicians talk about the economy, and I think, you know, obviously, you know, politicians, especially when they're in government, are going to have to put a sort of brave face on things. You've got to, you know, do a little jig and say,
yeah,
you know,
and the ONS puts a brave face on the numbers as well, I can tell you.
but you know, like, it's at times it feels like this is not, you know, they're talking about something which is entirely, you know, different from the lives that, many people are living, including you know, myself and many of my friends.
Yes.
You know, I came of age, you know, during the financial, well, just before, but during the financial crash.
Yeah.
And you know, the it does seem to me that there are now political consequences.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, you know, one of the things you're talking about there is that there's a lost decade.
Yeah.
You know, the real pay is sort of just flatlining.
Yeah. And it's low. It's really, really low. Yeah.
And I've also been struck by, there's been sort of conversation sort of intermittently over the past year over our productivity problem.
Yeah.
Right. And I wonder, how does that link in to all of this?
So productivity is low for one simple reason, which is that we don't invest. Right. We don't invest on, you know, investment in the creation of new assets. What we do is we invest in old Victorian or Georgian buildings in London, which were built, you know, 200 years ago, and we throw money at them, and they've miraculously, their value rises. But we don't invest in building, you know, flood defences or in new wind farms or in all of the things that we're going to need to tackle this big crisis that we're facing. And so we're in this kind of stagnant state, really, of the past. And we're calling it a productivity puzzle. There is no puzzle, I can assure you. The puzzle is why are we not investing? And we're not investing because we've never, ever recovered from the 2007-09 crisis. You know, there's been sticking plaster paste on the economy. Mm. People have been given insecure part-time jobs, low-paid jobs as a kind of emollient. But actually, we haven't recovered from that crisis. Things are much worse than they were before. So, you know, it's just that it's not an issue, productivity. It's invented by those who would like to say the workers aren't working hard enough. If only they were working harder and were, you know, like those Chinese who work so how many hours a day, unregulated and so on. And so people would like to blame the workforce, and that's where productivity really focuses at, when actually it's the investors and the lack of investment that is the problem.
Is there a...
And I want to say there's one other thing is inflation, really. You know, I mean, nobody talks about this, but we are living through what is effectively a deflationary era. And what that indicates is that we're below capacity. You know, we are capable of doing much more. You know, we're not capable of consuming much more or burning much more fossil fuel, but as workers, as people, we're capable of doing a lot. There's a lot of idle resources in our economy, a lot of idle people. There are a lot of young kids with enormous brains and wonderful ideas who are being wasted, who are in part-time horrible jobs delivering pizzas or working in coffee shops and so on and so forth. That is wastage, really. And it's reflected in the fact that lack of capacity is reflected in inflation. And, you know, that's the other thing economists are forever scratching their heads about. Why doesn't inflation rise? Why isn't it going up? Everybody thought, you know, by pumping QE into the economy, we're going to have massive inflation. So a lot of conservative and very right-wing economists are deeply embarrassed by the fact there's no inflation. But nobody's analysing that is a problem. There's a problem when there's no inflation at all. Now, what the central bank is doing is pumping out enough credit to stop it falling below zero. But actually, if they hadn't done that, we would be well below zero. Now, a deflationary environment in a world of very high levels of debt is a terrible world to live in, because while your wages are falling and are low, below real terms, your debt relative to wages keep rising in this kind of environment. So silently and wickedly, the people who are creditors, who have issued this debt, are getting riches.
They're amassing this asset, which they're is massive, growing and growing,
massive,
yeah.
You know, debt. Now, until that collapses and falls down, which it may do, and everybody defaults on their debt, they're getting fat and rich on the back of it. And we don't even know it's happening in a way, because inflation is an invisible thing to us. So that's
the
thing.
I was going
to
ask if there was an economic criterion that we should pay attention to. I think you've just answered that question.
That's the one.
So I was also going to ask whether you think there's another crash coming, but I think, you know, it's so hard
Look, everybody knows there's one coming.
Yeah.
You know, when the IMF tells you that corporate debt is beyond sustainable, you know it's big. Yeah. That everybody's in on that act.
So I guess the question then, you know, it's just this sort of the last little bit really of the show is to ask, because it does seem clear to me that and we've talked a little bit about sort of macroeconomic positions today,
yes,
and how people think about macroeconomics.
Yeah.
But it does seem to me that the way the political parties are thinking about the economy is changing and has changed. I think that's certainly true in the Labour Party.
Yeah.
I find it hard to figure out what the Conservative Party thinks about the economy at the moment, because it seems to me quite contradictory.
Indeed.
I think perhaps the only party that hasn't changed is the Liberal Democrats. We had Vince Cable this week saying, "Well, these spending promises were very, very unrealistic."
Yeah,
you know, they you know, finger wag. They must be, you know, stop playing Santa Claus is the term I can use. So, what's your sense of how let's say we understand what the Liberal Democrats think, because
the Liberal Democrats are neoliberals. They are the most sound and reliable neoliberals in our political system. The Tories are not sound neoliberals. Mm-hmm. The Tories are worried because they can see it's unpopular. They could see what Philip Hammond was doing was not popular, and they ousted him, in my view, rightly, because, you know, he was reinforcing Osborne's plan for austerity when it was clear that Osborne had been sacked by Mrs. May precisely because of austerity. And Philip Hammond just carried on as if nothing had happened. So the Tories are fantastically opportunist. You know, I don't think they care a damn about, you know, macroeconomics or principles or the deficit, all of that. That is all just mudslinging as far as they're concerned. And we've seen, I remember Dick Cheney saying, Dick Cheney, number two to George Bush, Vice President of the United States, deficits don't matter, you know. The Republicans, Reagan was a Keynesian, spent money like crazy, you know, then got inflation and blamed everybody else for it, really. So they are spineless and shameless when it comes to doing whatever they can to stay in power. The Lib Dems, to give them credit, stick with their neoliberalism very solidly. You know, they're so pro-euro and so pro the market that they'll sacrifice themselves for that, really. The Tories are not prepared to go to that sort of extreme. They're far too opportunist. And I must say, I'm hugely encouraged by all the work that John McDonnell has done and in transforming the way the Labour Party thinks about the economy, and in particular the macro economy, and challenging some of the household analogies and the IFS and the OBR and so on. And that's why I really hope they are elected, because we've got to transform those institutions and get a much more intelligent perspective on the economy. And of course, Navarra Media will take the lead in all this.
if only we were large enough to be a player on the level of the IFS.
Yeah.
And thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful, as always.
Thank you very much.
That's it. My thanks to Anne Pettifor. You can catch up with all the election news on navarramedia.com, as well as checking out our social feeds for links to our election time newsletters, as well as check out our daily election briefing, The Burner, which is out every morning at 7:30 a.m. We'll be back here at the same time, in the same place, next week. Bye-bye. This podcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. You can find more podcasts, as well as video interviews and articles, at our website, navarramedia.com. And you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Navarra Media. We're not funded by advertisers or wealthy backers, but rely on our subscribers. We ask for just 1 hour of your wage a month to keep us going. You can sign up at support.navarramedia.com and give us just 1 hour of your wage a month so we can keep working round the clock. That's support.navarramedia.com.